This is CliffCentral.com.
Listen, we've managed to get our systems up and running here, so I'm very happy to welcome to the show Polly van Wyk, who, of course, a journalist of great renown. Polly, it's nice to talk to you. How are you?
Morning, Gareth. I'm fine. Thank you. And you?
Yeah, very, very good. Thank you. I've been following you on social media over the last few days. You've been posting quite a lot of interesting stuff. It seems that everything in South Africa is controversial these days, and it's hard to tell what's opinion and what's news with some people. It's one of the reasons I like having you on, because you're very good at separating the two and making sense of some very complex situations. So thank you for being part of the Burning Platform this morning, which is brought to you by Nando's. So, Polly, couple of things to talk about. Can we start with SARS? Because it's the tax year end for a lot of people. So people are filing their taxes. Apparently there are queues around the block at all the SARS offices. And SARS itself has major, major problems.
Yeah, indeed. So what we are looking at the moment, and what's very big news, is the Commission of Inquiry into SARS. So this Commission of Inquiry into SARS started when the President realized that there are big problems inside SARS. Mr. Tomiyoni was the Commissioner's appointment.
Yeah.
In 2014, and Mr. Muyani went in with a bang at the time and started changing things without realizing and without an in-depth knowledge of the actual business of SARS. So what we've been hearing this week is the second set of public hearings in this state of or Commission of Inquiry into SARS. Now, the testimony is shocking, yet unsurprising to those of us who have written about SARS since 2014. This week, for example, highlighted the role of consulting firm Bain and Company, who was paid over 200 million rand to devise and design a new operating model. Now, an operating model is sort of that blueprint or an architectural drawing, if you will, of this house that you want to build. Now, this operating model that Bain & Company was supposed to design was meant to give to be this architectural drawing of how SARS should conduct its business, how its units should be structured, how its reporting lines should be structured, and which units should report to where. Now, that sounds all dreary and dull, but it's extremely important. As we've seen, for these crucial units and functions were written out of the SARS structure, the enforcement capacity was decimated, SARS lost its ability to measure compliance, and consequently tax collection tanked because of it.
Well, we know from the guys who wrote that book about the SARS rogue unit, and that was really when the institution started being hollowed out. Adrian Lacay and von Lochrenberg were the ones who wrote that book. And it was a bit of a bombshell at the time, because we realized suddenly how much nefarious activity was going on under Tom Muyane and how much he had eviscerated SARS. You've been following this story for a long time. How are they doing in trying to remedy this situation? Because while they're trying to fix it, it's not as if taxes stop. It's not as if government stops spending. It's not as if they can take a hiatus to clean things up and then carry on once it's all sorted. They have to do this while it's running.
That is such a good point to make, and unfortunately, I don't have good news. Mr. Muyani has set us back 5 years in terms of development, and again, that sounds like a small thing, but it is actually crucial, because criminals get smarter and smarter, and technology develops by the hour at the moment. Now, if you put an organization that is actually based on the most modern technology available, like SARS, if you put that organization 5 years back in terms of its growth and in terms of how it tracks criminals, tracks their own taxpayers and so on, it is a decimation of its ability to collect revenue, which is its core function. And that is, again, important, because our government has a very big and extensive spending program. Mm. Now, we've already seen it, because SARS, the consequences, because SARS hasn't collected the taxes that they aim to. They fell short of a few billion in two consecutive years, at least.
And people are also saying that part of the reason that we have that shortfall is because, obviously, of gross expenditure and not necessarily legitimate expenditure in all the parastatals, but also because so many people who should have been taxed white-collar criminals, friends of politicians, people who are doing pretty dodgy things, actually, when it comes to things like illicit cigarette trade and that kind of thing. These people have not made their contribution to the fiscus. They have not paid their taxes, and a lot of very powerful, very connected people don't ever pay their taxes. And then it falls to the rest of us to have to make up that shortfall, which is obviously not fairer, right? But it also speaks to the investigative capacity of SARS, which is at an all-time low. Am I right?
Absolutely. Now allow me to sort of explain how it should work, and then we will understand what happened and why it is so important. So this Bain model, this Bain and Company model, changed the investigative capacity. It disbanded certain very crucial units that work with high net worth and very sensitive cases, like the Mark Liffman case, who owes SARS 400 million, like the Robert Huang case, who owes SARS 3 billion, like the Gupta case, actually. We don't even know what the assessment into their tax matters are at the moment. I can tell you that SARS actually paid them that of over 420 million rather than actually collect tax from them. So when you decimate your investigative capacity and you don't have the capacity to measure the tax that you get in and how compliant your taxpayers are, you are actually blind and you're not fulfilling your core function as SARS. Now, that is exactly what happened. And in terms of the enforcement division, now in terms of and something that works quite closely with that is the disbandment of the large business center, and that was equally important because this center is the was the unit that worked with mega taxpayers, high net worth individuals, but specifically with high net worth companies. Hmm. Now these companies, we shouldn't think that they don't try to take chances and can't be equally as criminal as the underworld and the gangsters in this country. They would obviously try scams like profit shifting and layering and things like that. So, and that is important SARS.
We saw this happen even with companies like Steinhoff, and they were lying about their results. So why wouldn't they lie about their taxes?
Absolutely. And one of the ongoing problems is obviously that you touched on the cigarette industry. Mm. British American Tobacco has across the world been accused of sort of skimming on its taxes. We don't know what's happening in SARS in South Africa with them at the moment because SARS can't tell us. The rest of the cigarette industry is also in dire straits. When we analyze a 7-year period, since around 2013, 2012, before Mr. Muyani came into SARS, and then obviously in the period that he held the reins, you can clearly see how the cigarette industry made a killing. They didn't pay the taxes that they had to. The taxes collected from them actually declined sharply. There's clearly big problems with smuggling, under-declaring, and some problems at the customs side of things.
Wow. So this obviously means that that governments are going to be looking everywhere for funds, but do they necessarily have the ability to find those funds with SARS so broken, so debilitated? I want to look at other things that are going on because they are interrelated in some ways. The State Capture Commission, which has been started and I think began this week on Monday. Interesting.
Yes.
Interesting witnesses. There's some of the usual suspects we expected to hear from, Gabisi Jonas, Fakey Mentor, the people who really blew the lid off the Gupta Empire, people who we must be very grateful to as a nation because otherwise we might never have heard about these Guptas. They might have just quietly carried on defrauding the state and pillaging the state-owned enterprises the way that they did. But this is way bigger than the Guptas, right? There are lots of people involved in state capture. The networks run deep. They go all the way up, they go all the way down. What is for you worth watching in this commission of inquiry? Because we obviously can't take in all of it, and it's impossible for people to sit and absorb every bit of information that's coming out of the State Capture Commission.
Absolutely. So the Guptas are rightly, as you pointed out, only a part of state capture, but it's important for public morale and for a lesson to the South African public to know that the Guptas are being prosecuted for what they have done. And so the people that assisted them, like the Zuma clan, we're talking about Brian Molefe, Anosh Singh, the trillion guys. So, and that is why the whistleblowers in this tale is so important. Mrs. Msila Motepo blew the whistle on the Guptas, actually, when she 2 years ago told former public protector, the chief knew 2 weeks before Mr. Nene was to be fired as the Minister of Finance. Mm-hmm.
All right, Polly, sorry, we got cut off.
Did I lose you?
Yeah, but don't worry. We lost you, but you're back now. So you were busy telling us about when Fakie Mentor opened up about the Guptas and Thuli Madonsela, and then, you know, the Nhlanhla Nene being fired situation, which we all remember. We called it Nene Gate, and then you cut out.
Okay, so the matter of concern here is that Judge Zondo is chairing this Commission of Inquiry into State Capture, has said that he's very disappointed in the number of witnesses being called or witnesses coming forward. But I think the problem here is that it's actually more surprising that witnesses are actually coming out rather than being reluctant. If you look at Mrs. Msila Motepo, who blew the whistle on Trillion and Eskom and Transnet, she's been out of a job for 2 years. Witnesses' children are targeted. They are threatened on the pain of their lives and their jobs. It is not easy in this country to be a whistleblower. You can just ask the Gupta Leaks whistleblowers who are still living in secret out, and they fled the country. Now, so it's not easy being a whistleblower in South Africa. You can expect a backlash on the pain of your life. And so, yes, Mr. Mtabisi Jonas and Fakie Mentor and Themba Maseko, who was the head of government communications, is supposed to be listed as witnesses to this commission of inquiry. But I think the most important thing that we, as South Africans, should enforce from our government is some action after this commission of inquiry. And the same with the SARS commission of inquiry. I must say, I'm not a big fan of commissions of inquiries. They are advisory bodies. They don't have any executive authority. They are akin to a court, but they don't have the exact powers of a court. They can only make findings of fact, and in the end, they can only sort of advise the president. That is what their core function is to advise the president. And the problem is then that the president can choose whether he would want to listen to this commission of inquiry. And we've seen it many times with Mr. Zuma, that he just ignored a commission of inquiry's remedies. So if we really are patriotic about our country and we want the best country to live in, and we feel that this is a place worth fighting for, we need to ensure that something comes from this inquiry. And South African public can only do that if they start taking a big interest in what is happening and ensuring that there's
In other words, these commissions of inquiry, to Precy what you're saying, these commissions of inquiry are expensive. They don't necessarily have the power to implement anything after they've wrapped up. And so many of them have come and gone and nothing's been done about them that it almost feels like a bit of window dressing.
Exactly. That's exactly what's happening.
Are we going to figure out who the bad guys are in the state capture situation? Do you think that everybody is going to be honest? Do you think we're going to have any other skeletons come out of the cupboard? Are people who are accused required to appear before the commission and state their own case, given a right of reply? How does it work?
Yes, so I think we actually know who the culprits are. Now, if there are new culprits coming out, it would be sort of the lower guys, the guys who were forced to push the button, if you will. Mm-hmm. The last point that you made was important, is how would this work? Now, a commission of inquiry has subpoena powers, much like a court, but the problem is that if a witness do not want to come and testify, you're sitting with a hostile witness if you subpoena them, and that's always troubling. The evidence that they lead then is viewed in a different way. And this evidence is obviously must against the pros and
sorry, we just
are we losing each
no,
other
no,
again?
No, we're back, but it's just it that's the first time it was so crystal clear and then suddenly it went bad. Carry on, as you were saying.
So the witnesses would obviously testify to and against a certain point, and then the evidence must be weighed. But
can they be compelled to do so?
They can be compelled to do so, but then you sit with a hostile witness, which is problematic. It would be far better if the witnesses would come out of their own volition. But that being said, how do you get the Guptas or Mr. Duduzani Zuma or Mr. Brian Molefe or Mr. Anosh Singh to come and testify out of their own free will? Because it would be problematic because they will testify under oath. And if you perjure yourself, you have all sorts of problems. And then obviously you put a record on, or you put a version on the record, which is also not something that you'd want to do. Ask Mr. Tom Wiyani in the SARS inquiry. So, and again, the evidence must be weighed up and a finding must be made, and it will be a finding of fact. But again, this commission can only go so far as to tell us what in their mind actually happened. And then they can only recommend to Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa what he should do about this. They can't tell the witnesses, for example, that you are sanctioned to 5 years in prison. That we shouldn't expect that. What they can do is to tell the Hawks, you must investigate this, and this must be probably this will this there's prima facie evidence of corruption and fraud and so on, and that's how far they can go.
You know, it's interesting that because this gets referred to the president, people think, oh, well, then the president must just have people arrested, which obviously is not what has to happen, because this commission of inquiry refers things to the president. Then the president has to put into action the parts of the executive that can start implementing decisions that he would like to see carried out. But then it's a whole new process of inquiry. So it almost does feel like we're going about this in a very complicated way, where actually what should happen is that these people should be prosecuted by the criminal courts.
Absolutely. That is
why haven't the NPA and the Hawks been able to take it to that point and to that juncture, rather than for us to do this circumnavigation of the story?
They are able to do it. They're just not doing it. And that's the problem if you have a captured justice sector. These things happen under our noses. The moment the journalists started writing about the Guptas, the Hawks actually needed to register a project on the Gupta family, and they needed to start investigating. The same with SARS. And I know that SARS actually did that. And with Mr. Muyani coming in, those investigations were left by the wayside. So that is what happened when you have a captured state and a captured justice sector. You don't get justice.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's take our discussion to land, because this seems to be a preoccupation for South Africa at the moment. You've suddenly got people who've never in their lives imagined that agricultural land could be interesting, and suddenly it's front and center as the most important political issue of their lives right now. And I mean that for both sides. I mean that for people who are concerned about the land they already have, and for people who are concerned that they don't have any land and that suddenly they're going to be given some for free. That's obviously not what's going to happen. This is going to be a long, drawn-out process. At the moment, we're still dealing with these land hearings, which are supposed to wrap up in the next couple of days. When that has happened, they will submit that information to Parliament. But it seems that the president has already, in some ways, jumped the gun by announcing that policy is going to be directed at changing Section 25 of the Constitution. What do we know about the current state of affairs? I mean, what should people be concerned about? What should people know are the facts in this situation? And how much of it is about political grandstanding and creating noise before an election year?
all of it is about political grandstanding and creating noise and obviously attract votes before a year where we are going to a national election. So the land question is extremely important and crucial, and it's something that has been left for far too long. And the ANC is there to blame. Now, we all know that it is important to address the land question. When people were dispossessed of their land, it created certain family structures and certain economic structures that we still see to this day. So it is important, but it's also not that simple. Farms are usually bonded. It's not easy being a farmer. Yeah. Not every person wants to be a farmer. And you can't also just take land and give it to someone else. Apart from the fact that that is against the constitution, it would also be problematic for foreign investments, and it would mean that our economy would tank once we actually do that. Now, it's very difficult to actually explain or clearly what it is that Mr. Ramaphosa is working to, because we don't know. On the one hand, he says we will expropriate land, and on the other hand, he says we will do so in a way that doesn't affect the economy. Well, it already did. We can see what's happened to the rand. We can see what's happened to foreign investment. Capital flight is the thing of the day. So it is very important that he actually holds a line, which he's not doing at the moment. But I did see that AgriSA, and I think we should really sort of strengthen their hand, because they are very measured, they are well informed, and they are trying to do the best for all farmers, black and brown and white farmers in this country. They have met with Mr. Ramaphosa and his deputy, Mr. Mabuza, and talked to them about this land question. And the end of that was that Mr. Ramaphosa appointed some of them as advisors in a panel on the land question. We should all be very concerned about what's happening, and we should all be very active in what is happening. We cannot allow the politicians to decide for us, because if we allow that, we will sit with a huge problem.
I'm curious also, there are lots of people who are talking about what the president's saying and what he's doing, and the update here is something also I want to pick your brain on. He was in Parliament yesterday and he addressed some of these land issues. But I think most of us aren't so interested in what the president says, but rather in what he does, because he's trying to walk this middle line between pleasing the populists in his own party, who want to talk about expropriation without compensation, and then understanding, you know, the basic economics of depriving people of their property, which is the foundation of the economy. But more importantly, what did he do in Parliament yesterday? And what has he promised people he will do?
So they promised again that they will not negatively impact the economy, that they will not ensure that, or that they will ensure that the past wrongs be redressed. But it is important for Mr. Ramaphosa to also consult his NEC, and it's a point that you highlighted, that Mr. Ramaphosa sits with a very fractured ANC. It's very difficult to do the right thing by all South Africans, because there's so much interest, but it's also very difficult to do the right thing when your own political party is fractured and sort of pulls in different ways. And then obviously they're sitting with the EFF question, where the EFF has actually brought this debate to the table and forced the ANC to adopt it in December at their NEC meeting as an official point to work towards for the next elections.
So, I mean, your calendar at the moment is taken up by state capture commissions, SARS, and the land question. Are there any other things that are going on that we're not paying attention to that we should be?
Yes. So, Mr. Abrams, Sean Abrams, who is the head of the National Prosecuting Authority, has been effectively fired out of his job after the case went to the Constitutional Court. Now, that is very important because we are at the moment waiting for Mr. Ramaphosa's appointment of a new head of the Prosecuting Authority. Now, we've spoken or everything that you and I talked about this morning is actually a symptom of a lawless country. It's a symptom of a country that doesn't have an effective justice sector, that has a prosecuting authority that's not doing its job, and a hawks department that has totally imploded. And I actually fear that the hawks and the prosecuting authority do not have the capability and the ability anymore to actually put together a prosecutable case. Now, for that reason, and against that background, it is extremely important that South Africans very carefully scrutinize the appointment of Mr. Ramaphosa. No head of the National Prosecuting Authority since the advent of democracy has actually concluded their 12-year term, which is a huge indictment on this country and obviously on the politicians. Every president of state since Thabo Mbeki so far has tried to manipulate and use the National Prosecuting Authority to their own whim. Mm-hmm. It started with Mbeki Tele. The Interpol head and the head of police. Now I'm forgetting his name. Jackie Salibi.
Yes.
It started with Jackie Salibi. Vusi Pikoli was kicked out. It started
Bulelani Ngqoka.
Exactly. So, and that situation gave us Zuma actually as a president when they tried to use the National Prosecuting Authority to as a stick almost in which they could badger Mr. Zuma. So, the NPA should be totally independent from governments and should be totally independent from the whims of politicians. So the candidate that is to be employed or appointed is crucial. This must be a person with extreme wisdom, with extreme knowledge of the politics, who is not a political player, who will stand strong, who is quite headstrong and sometimes belligerent, and will not allow himself to be dictated by his boss. Now that would be a very special person. I'm not sure who we will get or what candidate we actually have for that position.
It's helped the president, all the presidents that we've had, to have weak national director of public prosecutions, because when they themselves end up in a sticky situation, if they have someone weak and malleable in that position, they can obviously make things happen the way they want them to happen. But this is going to probably be someone we've never heard of in the position of national director of public prosecutions. Are there any candidates that we do know about that might be considered for this position?
Well, the acting head at the moment is Dr. Silas Ramaite, and he's been acting many times over and never appointed. Now, he has grown up in the NPA. He is quite knowledgeable, and he might just be the candidate that we need. Now, there's also been talks of Mr. Willy Hofmeyr, who might be a good candidate, and some people have even thrown former public protector Thuli Madonsela's name in that. Mm-hmm. Not sure whether she will actually accept, but I'm almost sure that she will not be appointed either, because we know that she's not one of those that will allow herself to be dictated to.
Yeah.
And then there were also calls for Glynis Breitenbach, obviously, but I don't think that any of these people will actually be a candidate. I do think you're right. I do think Mr. Ramaphosa will try to find some new blood and someone we may not have heard of before.
And what will happen to Shaun the Sheep?
Well, I hear that he is out of a job. So usually when a court reverts a decision, the status quo before the decision must prevail. So what should have happened actually is that he would go back to his old job as the head of special projects. But the problem is that the whole NPA changed, and he told the country that he was advised that he's out of a job. Now, we don't know exactly what he's doing at the moment. I don't think he actually knows what he's about to do. He did say that he is a career prosecutor and that he would want to continue to do good for the country. Mm-hmm. In what capacity and you know, whether he actually is doing any good to the country is obviously up for debate. But no, we don't know what he's doing at the moment.
How many effective successful prosecutions have been completed under Sean Abrahams? Do we know?
Very few. So I can't, at the top of my head, remember the exact statistics. But what I do know is that if you look at the annual reports, over the time that he has been there, it has shown a sharp decline. It's obviously not only his fault, I must hasten to say. It's also the fault of the Hawks, who provides the NBA with sometimes unprosecutable cases. But it is also an indication of a justice sector in crisis, as we already discussed. It is a the declining numbers of concluded projects, of concluded cases, and successful prosecutions. If that number declines, you know that you're in trouble.
So really, if I'm going to take any golden thread out of our discussion this morning, it would appear that this is a great time to be a criminal, because you won't be prosecuted because the NPA doesn't know what it's doing and the Hawks are no good. It would appear that if you are the kind of person who cheats in your taxes, this is a great time to be doing that because SARS have no investigative capacity. And the president's talking about undermining the economy with land reform in a way that threatens the holding of private property like never before. So there isn't really much point in worrying about what you currently have, because if you owe the bank lots of money, you probably won't end up paying them back either on your bond if the EFF have their way. So what a time to be a criminal. What a time to just
sounds about right.
To get what you want and to rip the state off and to break the rules and to get away with it.
Yeah, sounds about right. We shouldn't allow that, though. We South Africans, we've seen that we have more power than we actually thought we had. The Zuma Must Fall campaigns actually brought us a new president, along with journalists and civil society and pressure from within the ANC itself, especially the elders. But we cannot allow this any longer. We are all very patriotic about our country. We love this place and we want to stay here. And we need to ensure that this is a place that we can actually live in.
Interesting. I saw Donald Trump tweeting last night about he's asked his Secretary of State to monitor South African land reform. This has got everybody running around like crazy. It's not usual for the United States president to comment on domestic affairs in another sovereign nation. This is obviously something that will also send some shockwaves through the ANC's meetings this morning, through the president's briefings, and through perhaps sections of South Africa's communities who are most interested in land reform.
Absolutely. And now it actually shows us how widely this is being looked at. The ANC and some of the EFF characters would often tell us that the West has no say in our country and that we should ignore them and that we should hold our own and do as we see fit. Now, with modern democracies and the world as it works in this new age, it actually doesn't work like that. We are all very interconnected. We are all looking at each other, and we need the foreign investment. South Africa is not a country that can sort of stiffen its back against the West. So this is just another sign that Mr. Ramaphosa must really think clearly and carefully before he speaks.
Well, yeah, it's not. Lots of people who end up in Trump's Twitter timeline are there for stupid reasons, and sometimes people are there for good reasons. We still have to figure out which one it is with this particular tweet. But, Poli, thank you very much for talking to us this morning. Sorry we had one or two breaks in the transmission. Otherwise, everything was great, and it's always good to catch up with you.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it. It's a love to be on your show.
Thank you very much. Poli van Wyk and the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's.
This is CliffCentral.com.